Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
As we start recording, it's all pronouns all the time.
It's all pronouns.
Hello, TERFs and trannies. You're listening to the Heterodorks podcast after something of a hiatus. I am your co-host, Nina Paley, a canceled artist.
I am your other co-host, Corinna Cohn, a gender activist, an evil gender, a mustache-twirling evil gender activist who's trying to kill children.
Oh, also, you are a pervert.
Yes.
Who wears women's clothing, and I am a handmaiden in your thrall.
And you also are a tranny lover.
Yes.
And we have a special guest heterodork with us today.
That's right. We have Ray Williams.
Welcome, Ray.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me on. I'm very happy to be here and looking forward to the conversation.
Now, I don't love Ray Williams because he's not a tranny anymore. And as a tranny lover, I only love trannies.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I still sometimes dress up in women's clothing. So,
oh my God, so you're a pervert? You're an autogynephilic pervert and you are forcing innocent women and children to participate in your fetish?
I do keep it in the confines of my house these days. So, But yes, I am quite sick in the head. So,
yeah. Well, now you've admitted it. So I think just leaving your house now, it's possibly a crime, or should be.
First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, and I'm really interested in your story.
I used to be a trans activist because I once transitioned when I was 28 years old. I was in grad school at the time, and the reason why I transitioned was because I had and I still have AGP, autogynephilia. I wasn't fully cognizant of that because I didn't really know what that was, or if I did know what it was, I thought it was an evil transphobic theory. I had been cross-dressing most of my life since a young child, and I identified as a cross-dresser for like many years. And then I discovered transness and thought that was like a good label for myself. And that kind of snowballed into medical transition, and I was on hormones for 8 years. And then I had an epiphany, or multiple epiphanies, detransitioned, and now I'm railing against gender ideology on Twitter, and I have a YouTube as well, where I also talk about gender and trans stuff. I guess I'm also an evil gender activist these days.
How long ago did you transition? How long ago did you detransition?
So I transitioned about 8 years ago when I was 28, and then I detransitioned in May of this year. So pretty recently.
Wow.
That detransition came along with radically changing my ideological convictions. I started actually listening to and engaging with gender critical perspectives, which I was very familiar with because since I was a trans activist and I wrote a whole book on trans activism and trans feminism, trans philosophy, I was very familiar with it, but I was skeptical of it and probably not engaging with it fairly, or, you know, at least I was viewing it from a very distorted ideological lens because I was wrapped up in trans activism and the trans ideology. And so I had blinders on. And, but then my wife actually started engaging with a lot of gender critical stuff and exposed me to detransition. And she is a D-sister herself. So she's been in the D-trans community for like over a decade. But she was also in the trans cult, trans community, I guess, or the trans ally, whatever. So we have been going on this journey together, but she was sort of like the impetus for a lot of my beliefs changing.
Wow. Have you read 18 Months by Shannon Thrace?
I have it on Kindle and I've started it, but I have a short attention span these days, so I've not finished it, but I did not get very far into it, but I have watched some of her interviews and I follow her on Twitter. So I'm familiar with her story a little bit. But actually, when I talk about my wife, people assume that she was like a trans widow, but we actually met when I had already been transitioned for 5 years. So it's not like I pulled a fast one on her or anything when I transitioned.
You did transition while you were married, though. You told her, honey, I have these powerful feelings that I can't control anymore. I think I want to be a man.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, we got married as two wives, and then mm-hmm. now I'm a husband, which has been interesting. So yeah, we're kind of different than a lot of your typical stories you hear about AGP husbands and stuff like that. So
well, you said that she had been interacting with the gender critical side of things for a while, and she still married you.
She hadn't been engaging with the gender critical stuff for a while. That's been a recent development as of this year. She had desisted, but remained sort of in the gender world as an ally or whatever. She had been, you know, in a detrans community and like aware of detransition narratives, but still pretty much, you know, on board with all the trans stuff, or at least the trans activism, trans ideology. But it wasn't until this year, due to sort of like having a falling out with a person who was very close to us, that she started researching this stuff kind of from a more neutral perspective, trying to like fact really dig in. It started with like the pediatric transition question, and people were sort of pressuring her to pick a side and get more involved in activism. There's like some legislation happening in our state, and people were like, oh, you gotta get involved in this. So she started, well, okay, so if you're going to ask me to be more of an activist, I'm going to actually look into the issue to see what I really think of it. And so she started actually looking into it. And it turns out when you, think more critically about things, you can come to different conclusions.
Is your wife, does she consider herself, or do you consider her autoandrophilic?
She has told me that she is kind of slightly autoandrophilic, but I don't think it is a overwhelming drive. I think if it's there, it's very mild. I don't fully know the answer, because I think that's something she may be doing some continued introspection on herself from my conversations with her. But I wouldn't rule it out as a possibility, but I think that's something that she is still possibly coming to terms with, but possibly could have been a factor in her original social transition all those years ago. So yeah, that's a good question, but I don't fully know the answer, because I don't think she fully knows the answer, but I would guess it's there a little bit.
I transitioned at a fairly early age, not compared to 2024 early, but in 1993 terms. Prior to the formation of my political outlook. And what happened is I transitioned, then later I got interested in economics and political philosophy, and I became oriented towards more libertarian viewpoints. What I notice in the last 10 or 15 years is that overwhelmingly, just hugely overwhelmingly, people get into the trans community in such a way that for many, many people, you can't really disentangle a leftist political viewpoint from gender identity. And given that you were an academic in philosophy and that you transitioned as an adult, I'm curious if that political point of view had any influence on you in your decision to transition, or in your attraction towards developing this gender identity?
Yes, to put it short answer is yes. But I think longer answer is I knew that I was more center left. I don't think I was ever like a hardcore communist Marxist. I I think I flirted with it, and I kind of knew it was like, I knew you were supposed to be critical of capitalism, and I kind of said the mantra, but it was always very like, you know, I had a belief in the belief that I ought to be critical of capitalism. But I'd say for the past several years, though, I sort of divested myself from that perspective, and I was, you know, been pro-capitalist basically ever since I got a good paying career. Maybe it was leftist, of course, let's say that's because I'm, you know, benefiting from the system, I guess. But but yeah, when I was in like academia, yeah, it's like very common perspective to be, you know, in the intelligentsia and critical of capitalism, blah, blah, blah. But I was never like hardcore Marxist or anything like that. But I do think you're absolutely right that those are correlated political ideologies. And now that I've sort of detransitioned, I have subsequently allowed myself freedom to not just explore different perspectives on the gender question, but different perspectives on like the politics questions and economics and political philosophies and things like that, and challenging very core things that I've believed for a long time. So I have definitely changed many positions, not just the trans issue, which is interesting. I think how the trans issue kind of like is a linchpin in so many like political beliefs. It kind of holds everything together. It's like a bellwether. It's like, oh, your position on the trans issue kind of like is a good signal for where you fall left or right of the spectrum.
What was your academic field?
Philosophy. So I studied philosophy in undergrad. I have a master's in philosophy, and I was in a PhD program in philosophy. It was a very interesting PhD program because it's called the Philosophy Neuroscience Psychology program. So it was like an interdisciplinary program. So I studied like philosophy and psychology. So that was always my interest, was like those two fields kind of like joined together, philosophy and psychology.
That would be a good field for AI.
Yes.
Is that what you're doing now?
No, I work in healthcare now.
Okay.
I work in tech, but it's like healthcare tech, basically.
Like the people that design the little Skyrizi on-body injector. It's like this device that's like a camera that you put medication in and you stick it to your body and it beeps and it sticks a needle into you and dribbles it in for 5 minutes and then pulls it out and then you throw it away. And apparently it costs your insurance company $100,000 a year.
That's wild. No, I'm more on like the software side of things.
I guess don't go into too many details. I don't know.
Yeah. That's the sort of thing. Like now that I'm getting involved in this gender critical stuff, I've been very reluctant to, I'm very like hesitant and worried about my career prospects because, you know, I work in a very corporate environment. And as you know, corporate environments have HR departments, and trans activists love to get people fired or try to get people fired. You know, I discussed heavily with my wife whether I really want to be public with my opinions on this sort of stuff, just because like I was worried about cancel culture very seriously. Mm-hmm. My job is what supports our family. So I sort of I think legitimate and rational fears about my job security based on the political environment we're in. But I sort of just was tired of living in fear. And can we curse on this podcast?
Sure.
Yeah.
I was just like, fuck it. And like, you know, I just decided to just like stop living in fear. Yeah. So it's been interesting, but I'm still not sure like how far I can take things really, or like where free speech ends and begins in terms of my career.
Well, you were an active activist and you wrote a book. So I assume you have a lot of relationships that changed when you detransitioned.
Yes and no. I mean, I'm Facebook friends with like hundreds of trans people, if not thousands. So, but when I detransitioned, well, also once I started my career, which is about 4 years ago in the corporate world, I kind of like fell off the activist bandwagon and I just kind of started living my life. I didn't really get too involved. I stopped being active on Twitter and stopped writing essays and stuff like that. Even though I'm Facebook friends with like all these like activists and stuff and trans people, I wouldn't say I actively friends and participating or was like very involved in the local trans activist scene or anything like this. When I detransitioned, it was kind of like not really a big deal. And to my knowledge, the local trans activist community hasn't really picked up on the fact that I'm now this evil person. So we'll see. But so far, it hasn't really caused an actual like rift in my social life, but that could very well change.
That's amazing, because I didn't even detransition from anything. I just said women don't have penises, and I lost longtime friends and have strife within my family and lost much of my career.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to hear that. That's like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, my family or my immediate family is pretty conservative. So they're, it's like I was like the prodigal son coming home from all this craziness. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it kind of helps that I don't have that many friends. So.
Well, I don't either now. But I wonder if it's a sign of times changing, because you just, I guess, went public in May, or maybe you said you detransitioned in May. So maybe
I said I detransitioned, but I didn't make any like political statements regarding that. So, and I haven't done any political activism. So you'd have to follow me on Twitter, which I don't really know how many people do that. They're just Facebook friends. So it's like, it doesn't really matter.
It's parasocial relationships. These aren't people who are going to show up at your house and help you move, right?
Exactly.
But yeah, they canceled me because of me writing this on Facebook. I wonder if this is a sign of how much times have changed.
It's a sign of how horrible and petty cis people are, Nina. It's cis people who canceled you. Trans people would never cancel somebody who's detransitioning.
Wow. Well, no wonder I'm a tranny lover. There just weren't enough trannies. The problem was all the trans allies.
That's right. You should have actually also declared a trans identity. Then you would have had friends that would have been indifferent to your evolution.
It's good to have indifferent friends. It's almost like having strangers.
Yeah. You know what? Strangers who don't cancel you are just about the same thing as friends who won't cancel you.
Yeah, strangers who won't cancel me are preferable to most of the friends that I had in 2017.
Ray, you had an interaction last week, I think, with Dr. Stock, if I recall.
Yes.
Kathleen Stock.
Thank you, Kathleen Stock. Say,
back when I was a radical trans activist, I wrote a Twitter thread at one point. This is back in, I think, 2018, 2019. It was like back when Kathleen Stock was making the waves in academic philosophy, because I was in grad school at the time. I was, you know, I transitioned when I was in grad school and in philosophy. So it was kind of a big deal, you know, Kathleen Stock, and there was like some other big controversies in the academic philosophical world about her, and she was, you know, writing these essays with other gender critical philosophers and basically laying out the case for gender critical feminism, trying to say that, hey, like, I'm not a bigot, I'm not a transphobe, but me being a trans activist and being also not just a trans activist, but like early in my transition, and you kind of maybe familiar with that, like how crazy people early in their transition can be about this sort of stuff. So I was, I wrote a Twitter thread, and this is archived. So there was actually if you search my trans name and Kathleen Stock, you'll find a article on the website Peak Trans or something like this. There's like some website called Peak Trans, and I was a peak trans. And so this Twitter thread is cataloged and archived out there somewhere. It was sort of me sort of like replying to Kathleen Stock, basically accusing her of transphobia. And like, this is back in the Trump administration days too. So everyone was a bit like, oh, Trump is like being so terrible to these trans people. Lives are at stake, you know, it's so terrible. And so I was very histrionic and, you know, dramatic, writing in all caps, accusations of bigotry and transphobia and like.
And so you're an adult. You are a philosophy academic. You have your bachelor's, you've got your master's, you're on a PhD track, and you're still doing this stuff, which is sort of like 15-year-old, oh my gosh, I'm having a horrible day, sort of like panic.
Yes. I mean, I think that is why I now consider the gender ideology as a religion, because it makes you a zealot. I was in full-blown zealotry. I thought I had the right side of history. That's what they always say. We're on the right side of history and you're on the wrong side of history. This is life and death. Blood is on your hands, like genocide. It's using this moral panic, this moral activist language. And when you are doing activism like that, you sort of like, it's in panic mode. You know, the world is collapsing. We're this persecuted minority. And so it was very activist, zealous language. And to my recollection, I never called for Dr. Stock to be fired from her job, but other people did. And I don't remember the full details, but she eventually, I think, stepped down of her own accord, or is pushed out, essentially, what I think would be a better way to characterize it.
Constructively fired, I think, is the term.
Yeah. Recently, in my detransition, I actually have gone back and read her book, Material Girls, and I found it to be very insightful, very rational, very reasonable, and I'm a big fan of hers. And I posted as much on Twitter the other day, and I think she did not know that I have had an ideological change of mind, because she responded to that tweet basically saying, linking to the archived tweet thread from my old trans activist days, saying like, this you, keep my name out of your mouth, how dare you, like, and then she blocked me. And then I realized that there's a, I don't know, it was sort of like, I wanted to like apologize to her for, she said something like, I had been one of the people who contributed to her cancellation, which is true. Because I don't think my particular tweet thread like really was the singular causative factor or anything like that. But I was one of the voices, and maybe the fact that I was an academic philosopher contributed to the perception that, you know, it really was true that she was transphobic, because hey, like a trans philosopher said so. So it must be accurate that she is transphobic. So then I made another tweet basically apologizing for having participated in such cancellation campaigns. And yeah, I'm truly embarrassed. I don't know.
Did she accept your, or did she see, or did she accept your apology?
I think I remain blocked. I don't know if she, and I never directly tagged her because she blocked me. I didn't want to try and go around that or try and, but I think people, screenshotted that apology and tried to show it to her, but I don't really know what she thinks of it. And I don't really care, because it's her prerogative to be mad at me forever. She can hold a grudge as long as she wants for all I care. I mean, I probably deserve it. So but I wanted to sort of like publicly apologize for having contributed to that. And there's probably many other things that I did that I am embarrassed about, but that was also many years ago. So I don't fully remember every unhinged activist thing I did, but I was one of those trans activists, like actively debating with the TERFs on Twitter, doing Twitter activism, getting in these debates about trans stuff with people. So I was one of those annoying people on Twitter debating everyone, defending the trans ideology.
We've had Katie Montgomery as a guest on Heterodorks.
Oh, interesting. Yes, I was
speaking
like,
of debates.
I was like her for sure.
Oh God.
But she's still going at it. She was going at it when I was doing it. That was like many years ago. I don't know how she's not tired of doing that. So
I like hearing you say this because it gives me a shred of hope, because I was hurt by so many people when I was canceled and people were saying these horrendous things about me that weren't true. And I have a fantasy, because it's like, how will these relationships ever heal, or how will I trust people again? And I am not one to expect apologies or other people to change, but that is like my deepest fantasy, I think, is that people will change and then say that I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can't speak to the likelihood of that happening, because like, I do think that it is a difficult psychological thing for people to admit they were wrong, because it causes cognitive dissonance, essentially. And people will dig in their heels very strongly. And it basically requires like a kind of epiphany, come to Jesus moment to change your mind. And usually when people change their minds, it's almost like a conversion experience. And you have to sort of like have a total ideological shift, usually you go from one extreme to the other. And so this religious ideology is reinforced by social status, because you want to maintain your status in good progressive liberal circles. And so unless you're willing to jeopardize your status in those circles, you know, people just stay quiet. I don't know. I don't know if that's a cynical or pessimistic take, but I do think the tide is turning, but people are going to be quiet about the internal changes. They might sort of internally, you know, acknowledge this stuff, but publicly coming out and like saying, I do think you're right that people are starting to change and the tide is turning a little bit from my perspective, but I think that's that. But internal tides changing is different than like coming out and saying so, unless you're willing to take a stand and potentially get canceled, which people aren't, because they want to maintain their status in good, liberal, polite society.
Since extremists tend not to be aware that they're extremists, and since gender critical people have been called extremists, I mean, I've spent a lot of time going like, am I an extremist? Is saying women don't have penises extremist position? But do you worry that, do you trust yourself? It's like having become a trans activist. And like you said, it is, you know, that's like a conversion experience. You know, becoming trans obviously is like a born again sort of experience. And then coming out of that is also like a conversion experience. Do you have concerns that you might still be out of your mind, but on the other side?
Yes, I have to have some concern, but you're right. It's sort of like you can't really know, because it's, we all have our blinders. But I try and temper that by doing like studying cults and cultish language and fanaticism, and kind of fanaticism broadly considered as a phenomenon. Perfect example, the blue dress AGP gate. So I'm hesitant to lump myself in with any particular feminist movement, like rubber stamped with like a prepackaged label with a prepackaged set of beliefs and slogans and opinions and ideological positions. I consider myself more, I try to be as free thinking as possible and skeptical. I may have fell off the wagon a little bit during my trans activist days in that regard, but I've always tried to be somewhat skeptical. And actually, if you read my book, even though that was within the framework of trans activism, I was skeptical of many mainstream trans narratives even back then. So the final sentence of my book was, I chose to be trans, and I fought against the born this way narrative. And you know, I sort of critiqued a lot of what I saw as philosophical silliness. And I never identified as a woman, because I thought that was like philosophically indefensible. So, even back then I was, you know, never fully full blown. I've always kind of marched to the beat of my own philosophical drum. So I try to think critically about things and like, yeah. So, and even feminism itself as a ideological movement, I mean, you can examine similarities in which I think studying history is important and looking at the intellectual lineage of ideas and sort of, I don't know. So I have many more thoughts on that and that like perspective.
Are you trying to be careful and not say that feminism has a lot of garbage in it too?
Yes.
I'll say it. Feminism has a lot of garbage in it too. Yeah, do we all agree?
Yes. Thank you for saying that for me.
I always go like, well, what are you talking about when you say feminism?
Yeah. There you go. That's a good point.
I think class analysis is useful as a model or as a lens, and it gets really messed up when you try to start to use that to attribute individual outcomes. So when you talk about stuff like male privilege, looking at how men have been able to accrue rights and property and social power and status at the expense of women historically makes perfect sense. But to point your finger at any particular man and say, you have male privilege, is that's not a model anymore. That's a misapplication of a model.
You're
not explaining classes anymore.
Yeah, you're saying that because you have male privilege.
Oh, that's so typically cis of you.
That's not a thing. Just go ahead and say that you hate women, Corinna. It's okay.
You Jews have so much power, Nina.
You half Jews have even more power because you're male. The half Jews are male. Half Jews have male privilege.
That's going to be our next product line.
Yeah, I think, when you start looking at the general structure of how these systems of critique work, because feminism is a system of critique and sort of looking at these sort of like oppressed oppressor and who's the oppressed class and kind of how it borrows that sort of similar structure from, there's one analogy might be Marxism itself. There's like the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, and then you just sort of like you replace that with like males and females, and now you have a totalizing system of like oppression that applies to like all of society, and it's a fundamental axiom upon which like all of society is like organized, and you kind of like sort of see similarities and patterns, and like you can see how there's benefits and obvious truths to that analysis in many respects, because there obviously is like real sex-based oppression. But I think my skepticism these days is in totalizing narratives when it comes to like explaining like phenomena.
And yet some of the most illiberal participants on the so-called gender critical side do not use the word feminist for themselves. So you don't actually need that ideology or that label to also have real illiberal positions in this.
Yeah, very, very true. But I will sort of also say I should probably be a little humble in this regard in terms of like giving my opinion on where gender critical feminism falls or comes short, because I am a relative newcomer to this side of things. So I do not want to say that I have all the answers, and my beliefs and opinions are still evolving quite a bit. Seems like every day or every week I'm changing my mind about one thing or another. So I'm still learning a lot. And
That humility, Ray, indicates to me that you still haven't left behind that whole female identity yet.
It's only women have humility.
Well, men are supposed to know everything. I mean, this is why I'm always explaining things to you, Nina.
Have you met women, Corinna? Do you know any?
Yes. 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 It's like constantly they have to be told. Like children.
Well, I really think that the faults that we find in the movement, whatever that movement should be called, I don't even know, the movement formerly known as gender critical, have more to do with human nature than with any particular ideology or school of thought or analysis or anything like that. So, I mean, first, anybody can call themselves a feminist, and everyone does, including people who, in my opinion, clearly couldn't be feminists. I guess anybody can say they're gender critical now, too, including a lot of people who I don't think are critical of gender at all. So I don't even know what that means at this point. Yeah, human nature seems to invite a lot of illiberalism in groups. That's sort of dumb sounding. Don't quote me on that. But you know what I mean. It's not because the ideas are inherently bad necessarily. It's how people use them.
And also I think it's social media, because a lot of this activism, you know, critique gets done via social media platforms, and that's about like clout, status signaling, building a following, and then everyone wants to like monetize their clout and form fiefdoms and Patreons. And I don't blame them. I would, you know, also love to have independent sources of revenue. But that definitely, think you're right. It's human nature. We're very tribalistic and form little hierarchies of like, oh, we're gender critical. I'm the good gender critical, and you're like a lower form of that thing. And I have all the answers. And people, you know, cults of personality, you know, and micro and macro levels of that. So
my impression is that because you were rigorously taught how to think, like meta thinking, thinking about thinking, that you may have inadvertently developed a tool set that you needed to recognize that you were in a certain ideological frame and start to take steps to dismantle that and use other frames or stop using the gender frame. Do you think that there is something just that you lucked out in studying or choosing to study philosophy, or lucked out that you had an orientation to want to study philosophy that made it possible for you to detransition? Or do you think that there's anything that is potentially repeatable and teachable about your epiphany that would help other people not detransition, but at least help other people develop an open mindset to have curiosity about whether they want to remain committed to their gender identity?
I think I did luck out in many respects, because my wife has been instrumental in this, because if it was just me and not her coming along in this journey, if I was sort of isolated in regards to this, if I couldn't like freely express my opinions and sort of say extreme things without worrying about her challenging my moral character or like assuming I'm a bad person, and like vice versa. Like, I think that we sort of like allow ourselves to explore ideologically, quote unquote, extreme beliefs and not assume that just because we say something that we're necessarily bad people. So I think it's about having like a social support system where you can kind of do this, because I think it's hard to do it all by yourself. I think it's easier if you just have no one around you but if you're embedded in a social group and everyone believes in the gender ideology and you're the only one and you can't talk about it, I think that's going to be hard. So, which is why I think you have to kind of be the change you want to see. And that's why I am speaking out about it, because I want to be a possibility model so that other people can realize that, like, hey, like I'm like, if you start having these thoughts, I'm not alone. And this is why I focus on the trans sports issue so much on my YouTube channel, because I think it is the clearest wedge issue into reality where like, I think liberal, good trans ally type people can sort of feel intuitively that there's something wrong here, but they can't say it. So, but if other people say it, and they say it in a way that's not overly incendiary or overly inflammatory or obviously hateful or something hateful.
Polarizing.
Polarizing, yes. then I think that can be the way in which more change can happen. And I have debates with my wife about this in terms of like language choice and like what is the best language to use in regards to this sort of activism. Is the term trans woman, is, for example, is it like feeding the delusion, or is it sort of providing a neutral term that allows people who are sitting on the middle of the fence to sort of listen to what I'm saying without being immediately turned off? Versus if I use language like trans identified male and like every single one of my communications, is that going to turn people off such that they're not listening to me? Like, what is the right language? And also, it's hard because there's this great book by this author, Amanda Morrell, I think is her name. I read a book called Cultish, and the subtitle is The Language of Fanaticism. And it's all about how language is like the primary tool through which like cults like function, and like cultish phenomenon. And that's one of the hardest things, I think, in the gender cult, is like changing your language, like changing pronouns, like pronoun usage, pronoun rituals, the trans women are women. The sort of linguistic choices we make and that we've kind of been programmed into, that is the hardest thing for me to give up, really, is like the language stuff. So I'm still internally debating what language choices I ought to make. But sorry, that was like a long-winded answer to your question.
About, 2008 or so, I was in college myself. I was a late college student. Some of my younger and more progressive friends in college started to really police their language around terms that, around disability.
You can't say crazy.
You can't say crazy. You can't say retarded. You can't say blind. Like, there's a number of disability-related terms that cannot be used in a negative sense or pejoratively, because when you do it, it's harmful somehow. I'm not sure how the logic works on that.
But it's stigmatizing.
To me, it's stigmatizing. I'm not sure how it's stigmatizing either. It's, if I can't find my car keys and I say I must be blind, is that stigmatizing, I guess? Maybe it is. Because I guess blind people probably can't find their car keys.
Blind people find their car keys just fine.
I don't know, Nina.
They use equally alternative but equally valid ways of navigating the world, Karina. So you have to respect that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I need to do better. But I noticed that they were starting to become very preoccupied by language. And it was really interesting to me. I thought it was maybe only a college phenomenon because I didn't see it in the world after that for a couple of years. So I graduate from college in 2009 and the stuff disappears. I don't even think about it again until about 2014 or 2015. Now in the real world, there's a lot of language policing. Even in some of the HR communications, we get the guides that say, hey, instead of using this language, use this language instead. So now instead of saying, that's terrible, kill it with fire, we have to say, that makes me uncomfortable, can we incinerate it? I don't know. It's like all this different sort of alternative language that they want us to use. And it seems to me like the purpose of it is not to reduce any sort of harm, but the function of it is to make sure that people are coming into alignment with a set of behaviors that somebody else has engineered, right? It's like creating consensus and behavioral adoption seems to be the main purpose of it, not to actually fix anything. And the similar sort of things are in trans world and seem really to be embraced in the trans world also. I don't know if you noticed that. You're going to see things a lot differently than I did because you transitioned at a much later era.
Well, my favorite example of language policing in the trans world is it is considered deeply and irrevocably transphobic to not put a space between the word the adjective trans and the noun woman. Mm-hmm. Just a single space can make or break transphobia in language. I always thought that was like interesting. I don't have an explanation really of like why the language, other than the fact that it's like, it's a status. I think it's a status thing. It's a status signal. It's virtue signaling, essentially. You sort of, by learning the lingo, by being more pure in your language, by purifying your language through, you know, the sanctification of your language, by, you know, removing all ableism, all racism, all transphobia, all homophobia, removing every ism, by purifying your language, reading all the books, all the tumblers, you can signal your moral purity, which when you are otherwise not doing so hot in the hierarchy of humanity, you can kind of signal your superiority to other people morally and say like, well, I don't have an amazing job. I'm living in my mom's basement, but hey, I'm better than you. So therefore I'm winning. So I think it's a status signaling, virtue signaling mechanism, which is like a social phenomenon in the human species.
It's also related to class, as Rob Henderson would say. It's a luxury belief. And because these are so, they did get into colleges. And Corinna, when you were talking, I thought about how many people have college degrees now that didn't, let's say 30 years ago, maybe at the same jobs. And I imagine probably everybody at your job has a college degree.
The smartest people I know don't, but everyone else does.
Yeah. I'm one of those people. I'm one of the smartest people, you know, and I don't have a degree.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons that so many people go to college and get degrees who really aren't suited for it is that it's just associated with class. It's the same reason people have white weddings. It's like, raises you somehow, or it's an aspirational thing, aspirational luxury belief. Ray, I wanted to ask you some questions about your transition.
Sure.
So this is audio only, so people cannot see your image, but you just look like a dude. And you know, if you were like walking around and were like, yeah, I transitioned, I, as far as trans ideology is concerned, like you were a woman, you were claiming to be a woman, you were living as a woman, and you said you transitioned. You said you took hormones. Did you do anything else?
No. Well, thank God. No surgeries or anything, just hormones for 8 years.
And what were the hormones like? Like, what effect did they have on you physically and also mentally?
I mean, just the standard physical changes, mild gynecomastia, softer skin, slight fat redistribution. But I think that
period.
What did you say?
Menstruation.
Yeah. Menstruation. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the biggest change that helped me, quote unquote, pass was, it might not appear like it, but I've actually had like 12 rounds of laser hair removal on my beard, and it was much thicker, much darker. So previously, before I got that, when I was shaved clean shaven, it was a dark shadow. And so when I shave, I think it's kind of come, the shadows come back a little bit now that I've on testosterone again, but that elimination of the shadow, like, so laser hair removal, I think, is the number one most important thing for passability versus hormones. Everyone's on like trans timelines and stuff. All these trans women, they're like, oh, the magic of HRT, estrogen's magic. But like, no, I think it does very little to change your facial shape. And it's almost entirely growing out your hair, thinning out your eyebrows, laser hair removal. Like those were the... I had long hair. I even had long hair prior to transition. I was a metalhead, so I had long hair. Still am a metalhead. But so it was those more superficial things that really helped me imitate women. And it's funny because, you know, I do appear relatively masculine appearing now, but and no one believes me, but like I legitimately was kind of successful visually, at least until I opened my mouth, of course, because I never did much voice training. Towards the end of my transition, I rarely got misgendered unless until I like opened my mouth, in which case people would just, you know, but no one believes me when I say that. But I was an astute observer of the female form and femininity. So I kind of imitated it and mimicked it and studied it. And I put a lot of effort into like my passing and my transition because I wanted to blend in. It's hard to think of me now as coming anywhere close to passing as one of those AGP Huns who never passes whatsoever or whatever. But I did a relatively good simulation of femininity.
How tall are you?
Like 5'10".
Oh, did you take anything to suppress testosterone? Because you just said you're on testosterone now. Is that like your natural? Like, did this do anything to your gonads?
I took spironolactone, which is a testosterone blocker. I took that for 8 years. Very briefly, when I was on injectables, I did not take spironolactone because if you take enough estrogen via injectable form, you don't need testosterone blockers. But I I got tired of the injectables and I went back to the pill form, which is very bad. I do not recommend that. The pill form is not good for the liver. And that effect on the liver, given also the fact that I had a history of smoking, just terrible. They should have, I don't know why they gave me hormones given that history and like not like explicitly ruling out that I like 100% quit because I ended up having a pulmonary embolism and like from the oral estrogen and also the oral estrogen contributed to extremely elevated triglycerides, which led to pancreatitis. So I had pancreatitis and a pulmonary embolism from the oral form of estrogen. So one of the main motivations of my detransition was the first impetus was health related. That's why I detransitioned. That's the first I medically detransitioned before I decided I would socially detransition because I was tired of being a lifelong medical patient. I was tired of going to the doctor every 3 months, getting my blood work done, tired of the patches because I eventually switched to patch form because it's like this more safe on the liver. But it's not good. It's not good for me. And I was just tired of being a medical patient.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
I really want to be a medical patient. So
you're getting your wish.
I'm
Nina.
Getting my wish. Yeah.
It's a lot to carry with you. What was the pulmonary embolism? How did that happen?
Well, I was in the hospital for pancreatitis. And then in the hospital, uh-huh. I just had a pulmonary embolism. Luckily, I was in the hospital because I could have died. Like, it was very serious. And it was...
And where was that at?
Like where?
Yeah, where is the embolism?
Oh, it was...
Oh, pulmonary. Yes. Yeah. In your heart.
It was in the lungs.
In your lungs. I'm not gonna be a botanist at this rate.
It was really scary. Luckily, I was already in the hospital when it happened. But if I had been like out hiking in the woods or something, like I probably would have died. If you look, look up like cardiovascular risk of estrogen therapy. Like everyone, it's well known that it has an increase. Risk of deep vein thrombosis and cardiovascular events and stuff. But you look at the research and it's just like, oh, it's like, you know, a small risk, you know, elevation, but massively depends on what's the modality. Are you taking pills? How old are you? What's your cardiovascular risk? Do you have a history of smoking? And I genuinely think the medical literature has an activist orientation towards underrepresenting the negative health effects of this stuff. And I'm very skeptical that the methodology and the data collection is adequately representing the true like risk of these hormones, particularly for the oral estrogen form, which is the most common form. I don't know. I sort of have a personal vested interest in like the like health consequences of these hormones. We all know taking oral contraceptives has many negative side effects in females. So, I mean, people think that it's like equivalent to take them if you're male, but I mean, I'm not a biologist or a doctor, but I just think that like fighting your natural hormonal system, especially, and also there's many negative side effects with spironolactone, which I took for 8 years, and that was, I never wanted surgery. So I was like, well, do I really want to be in this like testosterone blocker for the rest of my life? And like, I didn't want to do that.
When you medically detransitioned, I guess your body started realigning to its more natural hormone formulation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was interesting. I just went cold turkey, which apparently you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to apparently wean yourself off of spironolactone because of the electrolytes and the effect it has on your potassium or something like this. But I just went cold turkey. Having my testosterone fully suppressed, my T levels were very, very minimal. It's like 20 ng/PL. I can't remember the, it was very low. And then within 2 months, they were within the male range, my T levels. Hmm. So obviously nature is still working, very, very powerful. And I would say I'm not sure if my fertility is like fully returned because I haven't actually had my fertility levels tested. Things seem to be mostly working back to normal. But one of the things I noticed coming back on testosterone was just how much vigor and vitality that I felt in my natural male body running on testosterone. I felt like a lot more energy, just not surprising because that's kind of one, it's like my natural hormone. So my body likes it. And then also just testosterone itself like is powerful steroid or hormone. So yeah, that was one of the first things I noticed, which is like more energy, more physical vitality. So that's been a welcome change.
Did that not cause any sort of dysphoria or anything?
Well, I never really had too much of anatomical dysphoria. Like my AGP was primarily sartorial or transvestic in nature. So I really wanted, when I first transitioned, I was originally just like, I came out on Facebook as a crossdresser before I came out on Facebook as a trans woman. And then I quickly realized that like being a male and identifying as a crossdresser is not very socially conducive to having like a good career and social standing. So I was like, oh, wow. Maybe I should identify as a trans woman instead because there's more social cachet. You know, it was like 2015, trans tipping point. Like, you know, Caitlyn Jenner's in the news, like Laverne Cox on the cover of Time magazine. So trans women were like in. It was like the big thing. And I sort of like quickly adopted that. Right. And then also, I wanted to make my life as a crossdresser good. I didn't want to be discriminated at. Well, if you look like a man in a dress, you're going to be discriminated against. You're going to get stares and laughter and pointing. And so I was like, well, okay, now I need to pass.
Right.
How do I pass? Well, I need to take hormones and get laser hair removal. And then and only then, when I started to socially transition, that I started developing what I would consider rapid onset gender dysphoria, which was like I started hating everything about my body that was masculine. Whereas previously, you know, when I went into puberty, I liked puberty. I didn't grow up like hating my body. I didn't grow up like hating things about myself that were masculine. But when I decided to socially transition and when I decided I wanted to pass, that's when I started hating all these things about my body. And so I started developing like that dysphoria. But once I detransitioned, I made peace with my sex body, made peace with being male, I made peace with being a man. And then I stopped, you know, all that dysphoria went away because I didn't want to pass anymore.
That's interesting. Once I guess my route through wherever I'm at was a little bit different from the route you took. But when I got to the point where I could say, look, I've permanently altered my body. This isn't anything that I can undo now. I have to live with the consequences of it. And I still have a lot of life in front of me, and I still have a lot of great days in front of me. I have to take advantage of that. And I'm a man who's been medically feminized. Oh, well, shit, if that's all it is, then now I can actually... now, instead of being afraid of like people condemning me or being made fun of or anything like that, like I know what I am. Now I've made peace with that. Now I feel like I can actually move on and have a happy life. And it sounds like it's sort of at the end of the day, just very similar, except I don't have a built-in hormone system anymore. Right. That's about the difference.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think it's about accepting reality. Ultimately. It's about coming to terms with like my maleness, because when I started my whole trans thing and when I took on the trans identification, I just wanted to run away from my maleness. Like I knew I was male. I never became so deluded as to think I was female, but my association mentally with the concept of being male, it just bothered me. I was like, you know, it just reminds me of what I'm moving away from. And I didn't want to be seen in public as the quote unquote man in a dress, because that is associated with, in my mind, at least, with shame, because, you know, my AGP childhood was very intimately connected to shame. And so coming to terms with my maleness has been crucial. And also not just accepting that I'm male, but developing a positive conception of what that means. And like not buying into this narrative that like men are trash and, you know, males are terrible, and finding positivity and like being male. And it's not right. A bad thing to be male. It's not a bad thing to be a man.
No.
So in the feminist or pop feminism culture, leftist progressive circles that I ran in for so long, it was like, that was not the message that I learned. And I do think that was like part and parcel of like some internal motivation for why I so readily jumped into the trans identity.
Well, welcome back to reality, yeah, Ray.
Thanks. That feels good.
I also wanted to ask, what is up with male philosophers transing? It seems to be a thing.
Like ContraPoints and...
Philosophy Tube.
Philosophy Tube. Well, Philosophy Tube.
That guy.
It's interesting. There's some gossip that... not going to go into it, but that there's a sort of weird parasocial... wanting to be ContraPoints, basically, and sort of the parallel development of their YouTube channels and the and other things that are interesting if you search on, yeah, I don't know.
On Kiwi Farms. It's on, yeah. Kiwi Farms.
So I don't know. You can imagine there's some weirdness going on there for sure. But definitely AGP narcissism be my guess there.
So just overrepresented among philosophers?
I think it's just philosophers are arrogant and narcissistic and want to like tell the world how smart they are. So it's not necessarily that more philosophers are transitioning, it's just like they're more likely to be like on YouTube giving their political opinions.
I would say we've had a lot of male philosophers on this show, Nina, and they've all been wonderful and humble and not narcissists.
Well, they haven't all been AGPs.
Except
they haven't all been.
Yeah.
Just some of them.
Open. Ray, I know that you make YouTube videos. I've watched a few of them. They're very interesting. You also talk about your thoughts and views and your reflections on like the current discourse on your Twitter. For our listeners who would like to learn more about your viewpoints and where you are on your journey, how should they follow
up with you? On both Twitter and YouTube, my username is Ray Alex Williams. So you can find me there. Yeah, that's about it.
Any books that you're planning to write? Maybe a sequel to your trans feminist?
I have thought book. About that. But these days, I don't know. I have a short attention span, so I just like to write on Twitter just because the whole book publishing industry, like it's like a racket. You get a very small cut of the royalties anyway, and nobody reads books anymore. Everyone's just, you know, on YouTube and Twitter these days. So, and podcasts, obviously, which are great.
We read books.
I listen to books. I rarely read them these days. So no current plans to write a book, but I'm on the YouTube train. And I have been writing longer essays on Twitter. So straight to the people is my approach.
Well, maybe that momentum will carry you all the way over into publishing again.
Yeah, it's possible. We'll see. I've been thinking of starting a Substack, so for more longer form writing.
I have one more question before we end. What's the biggest thing that you've learned since detransitioning in May?
That is a good question. I would say that it is very good to have a reality-based objective epistemology. And I've been learning a lot about the way in which trans ideology is intimately connected to postmodernism. And I was not previously aware of the full extent to which the intellectual lineage of modern trans ideology depends on that kind of postmodern and lineage. And so that's what I've been educating myself a lot about lately, is this sort of, I think that's, and the way in which people like Judith Butler use that obfuscation to sort of distort reality and get us all confused about our language. And so it's the sort of like learning to be more clear in my language and to state facts simply and not be afraid of stating facts in a simple way. And like being very, and not letting people get away with linguistic postmodern distortions that, oh, everything's a spectrum, stuff like that. Yeah, that would probably be my big takeaway these days.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. This has been great. I've really appreciated this conversation.
Well, it's great to have you.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us, Ray Williams. And as always, TERFs and Trannies, thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.